so
I'm still recovering from the James Wharton event. It was as nauseating. What did I just say a few minutes ago? It was more eloquent back then. As nauseating as it was charming in its preciosity and nerdiness.
Mm-hmm.
I sat soaking in a corner with some, I think it was purple gin.
Yeah, that was big there.
I was hitting that purple gin pretty hard.
Yeah, you were really endearing yourself to everyone there by loudly reading from Infinite Jest while they were trying to announce the results of... You don't even remember that, do you?
I do remember that. I didn't get a full read-in. I just...
You didn't read the entirety of Infinite Jest? That's true.
I hit the wrong party. I didn't... It was a Wallace Pynchon debate in right, Park Slope yeah. last night. I think that must have been a Commonwealth.
Yeah, that was just a few round zones down.
Well, yeah, I was also next week. I'm going to a Bello Roth one.
Yeah.
But that's one at which we just all fap.
I was just about to make that joke. I was like, that's just a circle.
They
jerk.
Make themselves. They really Drew, that's just a jerk. Circle jerk. You don't need to bring any literary materials. Just bring a tub of Vaseline and your engorged penis.
It's true.
It was a long night. At the debate, I think, I don't even remember who won. I heard conflicting reports. There was
Wharton won.
Some
let's,
chicanery.
Let's for the record.
I was a fifth columnist, and I was outed as such last night, and I'm happy that I was. Although I was talking a lot last night about Henry James's obscure hurt. I tried to use this phrase in as many interactions as possible.
Hurt.
He suffered from what he called a horrid, obscure hurt. Which he, from an injury he sustained while acting as a volunteer fireman. But my first question about that is, who would enlist Henry James as a volunteer anything, but especially a volunteer fireman?
Well, I think that's
fireman.
The first thing that's sus. I feel like he was maybe trying to be a volunteer fireman to like meet
to get
hot
some
guys.
To get some dick. He's like Whitman at the Civil War.
Yeah, exactly.
Hospitals.
Yeah, but the great irony was that in the course of trying to get dick, he injured his own dick.
Well, that's
possibly.
Usually...
Terminally.
That's usually how those
terminal
things
dick
go.
Injury.
A terminal dick injury. And there are some theories as well that suggest that that terminal dick injury is what accounted for his late labyrinthine prose style, which
I
can't
that
hear
have
anymore.
For that?
Maybe all the
is
energies
there, is there
were sort of sublimated.
Between hypotaxis and dick injuries?
There might be.
Well, something to investigate. There's probably a PhD thesis.
Well, I have a whole theory about this. I think I already tried it on one of our guests. Was that Josh Cohen?
That might have been the Cohen episode, yeah.
About hypotaxis inducing impotence.
Oh, yeah, wait. So, yeah, this is circling back.
Yeah, that's actually why I stopped writing altogether.
Yeah.
Because I wanted
you're
to
too potent.
Stay functional. No, I realized my potency was diminishing. And then I realized, just if you stop writing and become an alcoholic, you'll be rock hard.
Absolutely.
So,
and we can talk to Will Selfie about that because he has some interesting stuff about his dick and its relationship to his addictions in this book.
From what I've heard.
By the way, welcome to season 3. It's our premiere. I'm living in New York.
Welcome to season 3. Lauren has landed in the shores of family Brooklyn.
An undisclosed location in family Brooklyn.
Highly undisclosed. I'm not in the business of disclosing much.
My
lips are sealed.
Mm-hmm.
Loose lips. You know what they do to ships.
What?
Loose lips sink ships, I think was a phrase that was popular in the time of World War II. He was like,
is that right?
You didn't want to give away intel.
Oh, it was like about espionage, so-called.
Espionage, spying, that whole business.
Right. Heard of it.
It's sort of your wheelhouse.
That is my wheelhouse, actually. I think that's why I feel so sad when I hear about it, because it reminds me of my novel, in which I'm struggling. I'm struggling.
You're struggling? Well, we wouldn't be here otherwise, sister.
You are so right about that.
This is the titular, the eponymous struggle, okay? How do you think I'm not feeling so salubrious this morning. It's not even morning anymore, but it's morning.
It's 3 in the afternoon. Let's put this on the record. It's 3 in the afternoon. Drew's I'm just wearing sunglasses. Here
in an extraordinarily tainted, sweaty, clap your hands, say yeah t-shirt, which has seen me through multiple events.
You were wearing on Thursday night? Also?
Yeah, I was wearing this Thursday night, Friday night, and under my sweater last night. At this point, I'm just trying to kind of, you know, it's a tribute to the word that appears a lot in Self's writing about Knausgård. He uses the word accretion. So the shirt is becoming like the agent of accretion. I am accreting into it, on it, around it.
Right.
Others are joining me. You know, I'm trying to solicit the accretions of others.
Oh, is that right? I didn't realize that. I think my French press has a leak. Another pod motif, French presses.
French presses are actually now my preferred method of making coffee.
Is that really? I miss the percolator. I miss the percolator.
The percolator is a little affected and slow, and I'm just not into it any longer.
Yeah.
But the French press is economical, quick, simple, and robust.
I agree with that, brother. That's why I'm a proponent.
And so I stick with the French press. Also, it's like a little, I suppose it's a little precious. Although I think it's not as fastidiously annoying as the fucking pour over mechanism, which I used to operate.
Oh, yeah. Well, because you need like a filter for that too. And then you forget a filter.
There's so much
Will
paraphernalia. We're in the presence of a self.
Hello?
Will Hi. Self.
We're so happy to see you.
Happy to see you guys.
We have
from London.
Yeah, it's night there. I can see that in your window.
But so I actually live in this kind of mini Gotham zone. I mean, London's odd in that way. But I live in this little area of kind of purpose-built apartment blocks that are quite New York.
Are they council flats?
No, it's not really, no.
Is it terrace houses?
No, they're purpose-built, what you would call in London a mansion block. So they would have been built for... Right, but if they're not that posh, they would have been built for, you know, clerks or what were called computers, people who worked with figures in the City of London, where you can walk. It's about half an hour, 40 minutes walk from here to the city, the financial district.
I know about it.
Yeah.
With the capital C, the city.
With the capital C, yeah. So you're going to the City of London.
Well,
it's
triply confusing. I mean, the square mile of the city is the original City of London. It's the Roman city within the Roman walls. But it's also a metonym for London's financial center as well, like La Défense or the Bourse in Paris or Wall Street in New York.
And so it has
a metonymic content as well. The other thing that's confusing is that it's not the capital administratively of either the city or the country. That's Westminster, where the houses are in 10 Downing Street. And that kind of tension between Westminster and the city has existed for a millennium. I mean, it's been a long time. It's London is a city made of two centers. It's a duopoly in that way.
So true.
Are you a scholar of this tension?
Yeah, Will is like an urbanist / planner. That's something I've been noticing about you. Yeah.
I don't know. I think if you're 60 years old and you still live in the city of your birth and you don't know that shit, you're just a fucking moron, right?
Starting out the pod calling 95% of your co-citizens morons. Probably true.
No, I mean, it's just, you know, you should certainly know that. I mean, really. It's like, it would be like an 60-year-old American not knowing that Washington was the political capital and New York was the financial capital of America. It would be that thick.
I don't know. See, I'm kind of an urban planning freak as well. And I find that most people I talk to don't know shit about planning and don't care.
Oh, you're right.
Really indifferent to the environment in which they live.
You're right.
Completely. Yeah. I'm applying to grad school actually in planning. I should have asked you to write one of my recommendations.
Oh, what do you want to do? What do you want to do at grad school?
I want to do urban design and I want a stable income doing urban design. I'm trying to remove myself from this bohemian milieu, Will. It's
You just moved to New York.
I just moved to New York, and I'm already
subsumed yourself in the very
milieu. I've been to like two parties. I'm like, oh my god, I can't wait to get a professional degree and have a salary. But this is what I'm condemned to.
Yeah, well, some of us choose Bohemia, others have it thrust upon us. It's like
I love when Bohemia. That's what I always say. It's like Bohemia was thrust upon me. I didn't want to drink and smoke all night. It was thrust upon me. I didn't consent.
Right. Well, I just think it's more the long tail of it. So, for example, my mother was American. I have dual U.S. British citizenship.
Right, Mrs. Rosenblum,
Well, she was never Mrs. Rosenblum. She was Ms. Rosenblum.
If she married her father.
But I never used that citizenship until after 9/11 when I couldn't get into the States any longer because I have felony convictions, right? So, now I have to, my half brother's like not well, he's in his 70s. I want to give up my US citizenship. It brings me no fucking benefits at all, apart from having to file a fucking IRS return every year.
Oh, right? Do you really?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, the chutzpah to audit Will Self across the pond. I'm so sorry.
So, but if I give up my citizenship, I won't be able to get into the States. So, that's what I mean by having bohemianism thrust upon you, because those kind of drug convictions, which date back to the early 1980s and 1990s, still fucking dog me decades later, right?
Do they inhibit you from attaining certain certificates or services?
Well, they inhibit me from going to America if I renounce my US citizenship. That's what.
Oh,
yeah,
really? That's why? Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Because you were such a user and layabout in the 80s, they're just not going to let you in.
They don't let anybody. I mean, it's two things. One is, when I went in after 9/11, the guy on immigration, you always used to lie on the visa waiver and you just tick all these boxes because the computers weren't joined up. But after 9/11, they linked the police national computer in the UK with the Fed's computer. So the guy took me out of the line and said, we're sorry, you've got a felony conviction. We're going to deport you back to Britain. And I said, well, would it make any difference if I told you my mother was American and I think I'm a US citizen? And just on my verbal information, they went away and discovered this was the case. And then the guy said to me, I don't care if you choose to live in London. I don't care if you travel on a British passport when you're abroad. But when you come here to the United States of America, you are an American. And he wouldn't stamp my UK passport. So they let me in. Basically, he said, you can come in this time, but next time you come back, you have to have a US passport because you're a citizen and you can never come back without one.
Speaking of bohemianism, we were at a Henry James versus Edith Wharton debate last night, organized by some friends of ours, and we were wondering if you've ever heard of Henry James' penis injury called his obscure hurt.
I think as many people who should know the distinction between the City of London and Westminster should know that Henry James had his cock cut off. I mean, that's just fucking common knowledge around
it's
here.
It's basic. It's 101.
You can go and talk to kids in the street here on BMX bikes, and they know that.
Right.
Their mothers say to them, don't let your cock dangle down, child, because you'll end up like Henry James.
Right.
I heard it was on a fence that he injured himself, although the details escape me.
Something to do with firefighting.
Right, exactly. But I want to know, why was he enlisted as a fireman to begin with? I don't see him excelling in that.
And I think was speculating that he became a fireman to meet hot guys, which I think is a reasonable supposition.
No, I think it's just that, everybody belonged to the fire brigade then. They were voluntary, and it was the kind of thing totes.
Huh.
It was the sort of thing you did if you were a concerned and decent citizen. Everything was made of fucking wood and went up in flames the whole time. And they did have professional firefighting forces. So
I'm sorry. I know this must be triggering you after what happened to your city 400 years ago.
Yeah, it's a really bad trigger.
I know you have inherited trauma from the Great Fire of 1666 or whatever it is. Mm. It's 1666, right?
Yeah.
I was just reading about that. I mean, remarkable. Yeah. So do you think trauma existed? Because the whole argument of this essay is that trauma is not like a historical constant. So were those people from the Great Fire of London, were they traumatized? Yes or no, Will Self?
No, probably not.
They did a little panel style thing?
No, totally not. I mean, you expected things to go up in flame. Yeah. You know, that it happened the whole time. And the point is, it wasn't a collapse of an internally functioning system that had lulled people into forgetting that it could collapse.
Right.
You know, these cities burnt down with unflagging regularity. I mean, the Great Fire of London was particularly big, but cities burnt down the whole time, like every few years. So nobody was laboring under the illusion that it wasn't going to burn down, you know. It wasn't going to burn in that way. You know, the reason why the railway becomes the kind of crucible for modern trauma is exactly as I say in my essay. In no other circumstance can you end up doing the 19th century equivalent of playing Candy Crush and completely fucking forgetting that you're in a very, very dangerous, you know, technology that can collapse at any point in that way. It is specifically the creation and what this great theorist of the industrialization of time and space in the 19th century, Schivelbusch, called the exact ratio. And the function is a ratio. So look at a pandemic, right? Everybody's lost their shit over the pandemic, right? Yeah. 150,000 people have died in the UK in a population of 70 million, right? I live in a district of London that is a majority Black British district. Most Black British people are either African Caribbean heritage or African heritage, okay? Mm-hmm. The people here don't wear masks. The people here aren't vaccinated. We only have a 60% vaccination rate in my area. When Omicron arrived, my immediate district was the highest caseload immediately.
Nice.
Okay?
Yeah.
I know these people. They're my fucking neighbors. I talk to them the whole time. They are not idiots. They are not fools. They aren't even anti-vaxxers. They just come from societies and cultures in which infectious disease is endemic and people die young. So, you know, they just don't even know what these stupid old white people are going on about. They just can't fucking get it. I mean, I was in hospital in November. It's not even mandatory for nurses in the National Health Service to have vaccination. I was being treated by nurses who were unvaccinated in hospital. Yeah.
Awesome. So, I mean, in a way, modern medicine is another technological bubble.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. The assumption by affluent middle-class people in the West that until it's time for cancer, or they've eaten so many fucking Twinkies that they're fucking going to burst a blood vessel. The assumption is that you're going to live, you know, at least your 70, more like 70. And anything that gets in the way of that is like a railway crash. And not only that, societies take on a demographic characteristic, you know, the US, not quite as bad as Britain or Italy, but these Western societies, or Japan for that matter, in the East, are aging societies. And if you think of the culture as being a person, Britain is an old, sort of dithering, incontinent, you know, kind of nervous, you know, judgmental fuckwit, you know, it's kind of...
Awesome. I kept thinking of, what would you call this? A schema of Freud's, if there had been no telephone, I wouldn't, what was it? If there had been no train, my son wouldn't have gone away. And if there had been no telephone, I wouldn't be able to miss him or be sad when he doesn't return my calls or something like that.
Yeah, technology has its compensatory dyads in that way.
Right.
This is like the awful thing when you start texting with, you know, a girl and then she stops texting you and the loss is so burning, right? But if you never started,
it's a purely theoretical example you just offered right there.
Well, I think that thing of the juxtaposition between the ease and the omnipotentiality that contemporary media afford us, you know, we should be able to connect with anyone. That exactly as you say, Drew, when somebody stops contacting you. I mean, again, I'm too old to really experience this in my life, but you know, I know from my
You're
children.
So lucky. Oh my God.
Well, it's like freighted with meaning now.
Right, being ghosted or whatever it is. And yeah, it must be awful. I think it's awful. It's like everybody's dragging. I mean, my analogy would be, I mean, I was already face famous when social media came along. So I didn't fucking want anything to do with it. I already had people bothering me in the fucking street, let alone, you know, by media. So I didn't want that. And I kept well away from it. And I had my suspicions about it, which is not to judge people that have gone that way. You know, it just seems to me like all of the disadvantages of fame with none of the advantages.
Can you expand on that a little bit?
Right. So, you know, anybody thinks they have a right to walk into your life or walk out of your life. There's a constant permeability of intimate with the social, you know, and how do you calibrate it? Almost every event induces a recalibration. I've been in pole position to observe this because I haven't done it myself at all. I could see how it's affecting people psychologically. You know, the thing where younger people, you know, constantly postpone the rendezvous, almost as if they're two points rotating in space and time that may eventually come together. And that deferral, you know, that exerts a continual psychic stress. Then there's the disjunction between the virtual and the actual. What do people know about you in the virtual world that they don't know about you in the actual world? How do you differentiate that? You know, my kids, they were all in, you know, grown up now and in their 20s and 30s. When I tell them about, you know, in the past, when you didn't like somebody, you just fucking stopped seeing them, right? And you never saw them again, ever. It was great, okay? But being famous is like a depth charge to your acquaintance. It throws up all sorts of mutant fish and disturbed shit from the ocean. And that's what social media is like. You never fucking get rid of anybody. You're dragging them around like a huge fucking net of these kind of grotesque fish behind you that you can't, and you don't know what the impact, and that's like being famous as well. But where's the advantage? Nobody gives you a fucking good table in the restaurant or lets you jump queue or goes to seats with you for no reason at all, except that you're famous. You know, you don't get any of that stuff, it seems to me.
I'm just walking around.
Haven't been going to the right restaurants, because I follow Keith McNally, the famous restaurateur on Instagram, and he's always talking about how certain famous people in Balthazar are AA, which means always accommodate. And I love his Instagram because it's an itemization of the nightly report from the restaurant.
Of course you get the table if you're famous. Yeah. What I'm saying is you don't get it if you're just some schmuck on fucking Twitter.
I mean,
you know, what I'm saying is you should be getting that benefit, Will. I don't know why you haven't been.
No, I did get the benefit for many years. Good. I'm saying I've had all of that. When I look at the way that, you know, non-famous people are, they've got Warhol's 15 minutes of fame, but they don't get any of the plus side of fame. They get the negative side of it. I've had heaps of the plus shit. Don't worry about that.
No, I mean, as a podcaster myself, you know, yeah, I'm just saddled with a fetid sack of fish.
Yeah.
A rotting fish sack. I just carry it around New York.
Well, I mean, unless you want to make yourself a social media influencer, and obviously a lot of notoriety is going on, but I don't know anything about that.
I'm only notorious for the rotting smell of decaying, you know, ex-girlfriends, the ghosts of the dead fish.
He did get recognized one time, and he's still riding high off of that.
Yeah, believe it or not, you can get recognized as a lowly literary, and I hesitate even to use that word, podcaster, in the city of New York.
Yeah, I think the problem is that actually notoriety is quite spatial in that sense. And even if you do pick up a lot of followers on social media, they're unlikely to all be in the same place. And it's unlikely to have that verticality. I mean, you know, I was the restaurant reviewer on the Observer newspaper in the 1990s. That was a big fucking deal. That was like one of the most powerful jobs I've ever had. I used to walk through Soho in the West End of London. Restaurateurs would come out and kiss my ring like I was the fucking Pope. I mean, it was so powerful. You know, one restaurateur had tried to fit me up for scoring coke off one of his doormen. And it's completely because he wanted to kill my bad review. You know, have a look at Anton Ego in Ratatouille.
And he looks exactly like you.
Yeah, it's based on me.
Yeah.
So I've had all that shit already, you know. And certainly by the time the social media came along, I think I could look at it quite objectively from outside.
Now that's interesting. You were a restaurant critic, because I think, aren't restaurant critics supposed to be rather anonymous? Like their photos aren't published, and you're rather distinctive looking. I mean, you're what, 6'5", according to Wikipedia?
Yeah, according to Wikipedia. Actually, yeah. Jimmy Wales came around and measured me personally. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it really works like that. I mean, I think, you know, I was never really interested in food or in a balanced review. I was interested in restaurants as a zone of bourgeois performance. You know, they're there.
You should definitely follow Keith McNally's Instagram then.
It's okay.
All about that subculture and that performance. All right,
but, you know, I did that like 25 years ago.
Yeah.
So why do I have to follow some other
person? He's reporting it from the inside, right? Because he's the one. He's this guy who's totally lost his shit, but he like owns all these restaurants. And so he's just like airing out the dirty laundry that none of the other restaurateurs want people to know, because he had a stroke and he can't talk. So he just, he just shits everything out on Instagram.
But that's a bit like Kitchen Confidential, right? It's not so.
It's a bit like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a bit like George
Orwell. Real time.
Yeah. It's a bit like George Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London, if you've ever read that. So he has a brilliant sequence in that, read it, where he's what's called a plongeur, like the dishwasher in a hotel in Paris. And I swear Anthony Bourdain got his shtick from that, because Orwell's description of what restaurants are like and how they create their effects is just brilliant. And I think he was probably the first writer who did it in quite that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, all of these are functioning systems that can dysfunction. And in all of these, we exist in a kind of state of anesthesia, of kind of unthinkingness, playing Candy Crush or whatever our equivalent is. And then suddenly it cracks and we're traumatized. But the point about contemporary society is it's like addicts. You know, you say of drug addicts, you know, did she have a high bottom or a low bottom? You know, did she fucking end up shoving a Coke bottle up her jacksy in order to get crack? Or did she just sort of whimper because she didn't have a bit of weed and end up sitting in the fucking circle with the rest of the jerks? You know, what happened here? And in our case, we've got a really fucking low bottom. You know, we've got a high bottom, rather, very high bottom as a culture, which is why we're so traumatized the whole time. You know, anything's traumatic. You know, your phone doesn't work. How traumatic could that be?
I mean, I want to talk about these traumatogenic technologies. By the way, some great coinages in here. I don't know if they're coinages, but you're, you know, whatever, like reutilizing them. Traumatogenic, what was the other one? Specular. That was a lot of fun. I want to talk about these because when I was reading your essay, I just had this like jolt of like recognition of like, A, the posthumous shock from Benjamin really fucked me up. And B, I feel like I'm traumatized by my phone intensely. I was like, shit, man, you know, this is like, I've had the intuitive sense that my phone is traumatizing me ever since I got one. But when I read your essay, there has to be some endpoint to this. It has to end soon. Either I kill myself or I get like one of those phones for old people, like a jitterbug. My brother and I were thinking of making a jitterbug suicide pact where we get, you know, those very low tech like phones that are just, you can do text messages on them, but that's pretty much it. I don't know. It fucked me up.
Do it. I mean,
you think I should get a jitterbug?
Well, I don't think you'll recover from the you are traumatized, but your trauma is pathetic. You know, you're not traumatized because you were in Nam and the fucking your platoon was blasted by the fucking Viet Cong and you saw your best friend eviscerated in front of you. You're traumatized because you might not be able to receive a fucking nudge or a text from somebody you don't even want to receive it from. You know?
Yeah, it's very pathetic.
It's the trauma of the...
Oh, no, what happened to Will?
It's cool. You back? Ah, you're back.
Yeah, yeah. You froze up for a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was just saying, you know, your
I wasn't traumatic... a nom. You're correct about that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, your traumatic situation is so, you know... I mean, to describe it as trauma is like, you know, you're somebody who would stand on a curb and get vertigo. You know, it's like, yeah.
It's exactly like that.
Yeah.
But I can identify,
you know, one of the virtues of being older is I can remember when there were no mobile phones. I was an adult, you know, and I didn't need one, you know, so clearly we don't need them, you know, so we know this.
Well, yeah, but you had like heroin to distract you and like do other things. I don't have that. Phone is my drug of choice, you know.
Okay.
I think it's an addiction.
I had a considerable period. Did I have a considerable period drug free and without a phone? No.
Yeah, probably. Think about that.
No, I only probably cleaned up in like 99, and I was an early adopter. I had a cell phone in the late 90s for 2 or 3 years, and then I got rid of it, and then I got another one. I would guess by about 2004 or 2005, I probably had one.
Yeah. But were they as addictive back then? Because I remember flip phones. I feel like, was I as obsessed with my flip phone? Because I would still like text friends on it and stuff.
No, I don't think they were as addictive. I think it's the kind of, I call them bi-directional digital media. I don't really call it a phone because it isn't a phone. It's a handheld computer that also gives you access to the web via the internet.
It's a bit pedantic, but
okay. Well, it's not a phone. I mean, a phone was a very different kind of a thing. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like what Nicholas
Carr. Yeah, but people also call a phone a horn, and a phone is not a horn. I mean, it's just it's a slang, right? It's not a myth, it's a slang.
Well, that's what we call a skeuomorph. I mean, really, I think the reference to the horn is the reference to the shellac horn on early record players and Victrolas. And when you actually amplified sound using horns, they had weird things like sound mirrors, concrete horns that were intended you could hear planes coming and shit like that. But I think, you know, it's what Nicholas Carr says in The Shadows, once you've got a tool that obviates the need for tools, it becomes a very different kind of thing in that way. And I think phones are very different to.
I think they're the terminal device.
Possibly.
I think they're the last one. Yeah.
Pretty much all I try and do, I've taught at a university for 10 years now, and pretty much all I do is just try and get the students to leave their phone at home. That's
right.
About it. That's pretty much all. I consider myself to have done a good semester's teaching if I can get 2 or 3 of them to go out for a walk without their phone. I think it's that radical.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Well, they're frightened, particularly the young women. The intersection between the sense of the GPS system, which people may not understand how it works, but at an intuitive level, they know that GPS delivers, you know, absolute location. You know, you're within a meter of, it can tell where you are. And they know that. They know that there's the permanent possibility of them being contacted, tracked, registered. And in an environment in which, you know, kind of media is full of, you know, exaggerated depictions, particularly of young women being attacked by strangers, you know, I think these two things intersect, the kind of global anxiety that a vulnerable young person feels, plus at least the theoretical possibility that having your phone with you might save you, absolutely locks you in to this matrix that the phone represents. And you know,
it's another compensatory dyad.
That's right. But in this case, you know, the anxiety is ill-founded, you know. So in Britain, I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't for a second wish to minimize the distress or pain of women at all, but there have been something like 170 femicides in Britain this year, okay? But of those, only 10% will be by strangers. 90% are going to be by partners or former partners. It's always the case. And you know, so your chance as a young woman wandering around in public of being mortally attacked is minuscule. there's another intersection there, of course, which is with sort of background harassment, sexual harassment. And what worries me, and when I look at my young women students, what frightens me is that they now experience, yeah, you might say, well, why should any young woman accept a guy on a building site whistling at her and saying, you don't get many of them to the pound, love, you know?
Wait, what is that supposed to mean?
It's the sort of thing you would jocularly shout at a woman with large breasts.
I'm going to try that.
The breasts are amounting to a pound? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, you don't get many of them to the pound.
You don't get many of them to the pound.
Yeah, you don't get many of them to the pound. But to
experience... I have to think about that one for a little bit.
Right, but to experience that, you might want to argue, well, no young woman should suffer any harassment in public at all. And I kind of agree with you. But to experience the harassment, as it were, the precursor to a homicide, which is how a lot of my students seem to be experiencing it now, is terrifying to me. My group last semester was 20 and 18 of them were women, for some reason, coincidentally. And none of them would go out alone.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, they just couldn't face it almost, except for very functional journeys to get to the subway, to get to the campus, whatever, you know.
Well, I think this goes back to the narrative thing, right? Like everything has to be a part of a narrative about violence, about gender or whatever. And so if a guy says, how many of those to a pound, love? Is that what it was? I'm still thinking about trying to understand that. To you, it's probably a prelude to like a horrific gang rape and murder because everything has to be fucking connected. However, most things many things in life are merely random. And that's what people have hard shit understanding. Because I famously, Will, I don't know if I told you this, it's become a lighthearted motif on our podcast. I was famously tackled by a guy having a psychotic break in the subway last year. And he like tore up my clothing and like with his fingernails, like extracted some red scratch marks on my person. And until someone pulled him off of me, but I felt nothing about it. It was like, I'd almost forgotten about it like an hour later. And I almost wanted to not tell anyone about it because then it would automatically get subsumed into some kind of narrative when in fact it was my belief that it was purely a random incident.
Well, I certainly think, I mean, while I'm very critical of thinkers like Bessel van der Kolk, you know, trauma theorists who, you know, attempt to, what for one, they believe in trauma as an anthropological constant. And secondly, they very much want to elevate it to a kind of master discourse, not just in
the humanity. It's a get-out-of-jail-free card. Yeah. Hmm? It's a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Right. But what I would agree with, and I don't know if you've ever looked at his book, The Body Keeps the Score, what I would agree with, clearly, because I've looked at the data, is that situations in which people feel some degree of empowerment are not situations in which they're often that traumatized. And so each potentially traumatogenic event has a number of factors in it that may that may supervene in some way or another. You know, you can imagine, you know, even as a woman, you know, if you were, you know, a guy jumped on you in the darkness in the street and you did happen to have, you know, a heavy object in your hand and you swung around and smacked him in the face and he reeled away, you wouldn't be traumatized. You'd just be fucking pleased with yourself and probably considerably empowered, you know, which is why I have a great deal of sympathy for, you know, women who train in some kind of personal defense. That seems to me a reasonable response to the possibility of trauma. But what we see here, you know, is, you know, I'm not an evolutionary psychologist or necessarily a biological essentialist, but you'd have to be a fucking moron not to notice that men are much bigger than women and more violent as a rule.
Famously, yeah. No, famously. I've observed that as well, yeah.
Right, I've observed that over the years. Sometimes in war zones where you see...
Although in some parts of Brooklyn, I don't know.
Yeah.
assembled men at that party.
So, you know, I think in a way, trauma gets rolled into a general utopian thing.
Yeah.
Kind of, oh, wow, there shouldn't be any violence in the world. Everybody's human rights should be recognized. Nobody should ever have anybody on a building site shouting at them, all right, love, you don't get many of them to the pound, you know, and so on and so forth. All of that really should never happen. So it's a kind of, you know, within the context of an assumed utopia, everything's dramatic, isn't it? I mean, it's
kind of- right, exactly, yeah. And people are sheltered, so they're sheltered and they're dumb enough to think that things ought to be a utopia because, I don't know, school curriculums or something. Or
no, I think people think things ought to be a utopia because we live with an ideology that is utopian. I mean, and that's something else I address in the essay, is that liberalism itself is a utopian ideology. Liberalism is a political ideology that believes in the perfectibility of human beings, that if you can improve human social institutions, you'll improve people's nature. I'm more on the de Tocqueville side of things, who said that, you know, the law exists to restrain people's worst impulses, not encourage their best. And I tend to view social institutions as existing to frustrate innate violence in people and innate problems with innate human egotism in that way. And I certainly don't believe that we're going to reach any kind of utopia ever. You know, so on that basis, you tend to find things, again, arguably rather less traumatic when they go wrong.
Yeah.
I wonder, you sent us this little essay, I'm not sure where it was from, about Knausgaard.
Yeah, what was that? Was that a speech?
No, it was an essay I wrote for the Guardian newspaper here when my memoir came out a couple of years ago.
And
why didn't you send us a Guardian link?
Well, because they cut it. They cut it.
They killed it.
Yeah. No, they didn't kill it.
Oh, they just cut it. Got it.
You take take issue with the kind of what you see as the fraudulent lucidity of Knausgaard, and I wonder if there's even a connection between your ideas about trauma and that lucidity, and maybe one of the problems you have with this trauma narrative is that it is in its way too legible and lucid, perhaps, and too
neat. I don't know, maybe you should read my work and then you'd know why I have a problem with Knausgaard. I mean, I've been writing fiction for like 30 years and have written a fuck ton of it, you know. So I mean, in my 50s alone, I filed as much copy as fucking Knausgaard did, you know. And actually, I would take issue with him just because he's not a very interesting writer. You know, there's a sort of monstrousness to his. But there's no poetry. There's no fucking poetry. Why do you bother to read literature if you don't want somebody to do interesting things with words, not just describe his child having a shit in the most prosaic possible way? I mean, his insights, his philosophical insights are beyond sophomoric. I mean, I tried again in the run-up to talking to you guys in order to see whether I'd been missing something. I had a look at the second book instead.
You don't like the kid's birthday party?
I mean, I think that he's an object lesson about what's wrong with literature in the current age. He is completely prosaic. And the very fact that you guys wouldn't, you know, you should, no.
From my own childhood. I don't understand.
From my own childhood, I remember only a handful of incidents, all of which I regarded as momentous, but which I now understand were a few events among many, which completely expunes their meaning. For how can I know that those particular episodes that lodged themselves in my mind were decisive? And not all the others, of which I remember nothing. This is not fucking Proust.
But isn't that part of its appeal almost? Its very blandness? I mean, the prosaicness.
Maybe to you, if you want to be some kind of bland schmuck, then maybe that's right.
I'm not, ironically, we're not necessarily acolytes of this man's writing.
An irony. Irony is situational and dramatic. Oddly is what you mean.
Oh, well, I meant insofar as we have a podcast on him, but our
still not ironic, Alanis Morissette.
Okay, oddly.
Why would you, you know, I'm a fucking writer. You know, I've earned my fucking bones, man. I know what words mean.
I know, I'm trying to learn from you.
You know, I hope it would be brilliant to believe that in Norwegian, if that's what he writes in, that Nausgaard were in fact creating this incredibly complex, dense, elusive, multi-dimensional lattice work of the semiotic that is, you know, being rendered into this tedious looking fucking carpet that's on my iPad. But I doubt it.
I don't disagree with any of what you've been saying. I think he has no style. He's mostly bland and prosaic. However, I don't necessarily agree with the point you're making about the false lucidity. Because I don't think that's ever been a premise of it, that he actually remembers this shit. He's openly admitted that he's made up a lot of events in this, such as seeing his father at the funeral home a second time.
Yeah, but that's metafictional. That's not the point. Within the text, he presents you with a narrative that is a narrator that's fully lucid in a way that somebody isn't even present in their own life in the moment, let alone in their entire life. And the reason I read you that particular excerpt is because it's precisely tropes like that that, far from undermining the lucidity of the character, reinforce it. That's the point. You guys should go back and read Sontag on style. You know, we live in a kind of painfully content-driven, prosaic era, and it's the death of literature. I'm sorry, it really is. And no, it's just not good. You know, as Sontag says, you know, style is content, and content is nothing. I mean, it's just fucking nothing. You know, it's like, it can't really mean anything.
I guess we disagree of whether there's meaning to be found in the accretion of detail. And you come out on this question like resoundingly, no, there is no meaning to be
found. No, I mean, you know, I'm sorry. You know, I'm allowed to be pissed, guys. You know, did you read my memoir?
Yes, I did. Drew did.
Right. So that's the accretion of detail, right?
Well, that's why I was going to perhaps a little provocatively suggest that there are parallels between your memoir and Knausgaard. It's a lot of accretion of adolescent detail.
That's right.
Wanting to do drugs and get laid. So, and yeah, and another thing, what it does is it gets inside a specific moment in time, right? Knausgaard famously in book one has about 100 pages about trying to smuggle beer to a New Year's Eve party. Right. And this book, your book Will, which should have been called Self, but we can talk about that later, is structured around five different moments in different years of your life. Right. And the first is you trying to get like trade croissants for heroin or something, but it like then it like devolves into different.
Yeah, memories. But I mean, you may say it's a fictional device, but the thing of writing it in the third person and the continuous present is that I remove from the reader the obligation to believe that the author is looking back on their life with complete fidelity. It's built into the theoretic of the text. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying about Nausgaard is it's all I this, I that, I the other. And that's a limiting constraint. If you're interested, I'll send you the philosophical paper Against Narrativity by the philosopher Galen Strawson, which sets out this thinking in philosophic terms. But I think that's the problem. Of course, you're right. The content, you're addicted to content because you're judging.
What can I say? I'm a millennial.
Right, but you're judging it in terms of content. Judge my writing in terms of style. I'm a stylist.
I'm not denying that there is style in spades in this.
The irony is I celebrate style, sensuousness in prose and flamboyance. Again, I don't know if I'm using the word irony correctly. The oddity is that I think Lauren and I both revel in style. That's why it's a bit strange that we have this podcast about.
I mean, it's a limiting constraint. Gray. It's a formal constraint. Yeah.
Right. Maybe it's to do with you perceive Nausgaard as a sort of hero of our age, you know, because what he's continually presenting himself as is a man who, you know, my struggle. the bathos is there. You know, getting a kid into a fucking baby buggy is like crossing the fucking Rubicon for this man. You know,
it's a provocation.
Is it?
What do you think of it as a provocation?
I don't think it doesn't provoke me and anything in me.
It seems like it kind of does provoke you.
That's only because I'm talking to you. You know, I mean, yeah, I mean, I certainly think, you know, a Nausgaard tax would be, you know, worth levying. I certainly think he should divvy up some of his earnings to those of us who haven't done quite as well.
I do like that idea. I mean, we should be getting kickbacks.
Tax for the, but no, you know, I'm not. I mean, any writer who says they don't want readers is deranged, obviously. And yeah, you know, during exactly the same period as Nausgaard was publishing his Struggle, I was publishing a trilogy of novels, you know, 500-600 page long novels, big novels, which I think have all of the merits that his books lack. You know, and I've been unable to find readers for them because, you know, readers say, oh, the critics say they're too difficult. You know, these books are too difficult. Yeah. You know, I've been labeled as a neo-modernist, as a Joycean, all of this. These people, these critics have never even fucking read Joyce if they think my stuff is as hard as him. You know, I mean, a pathetic decline in people's ability to read anything is extraordinary. I mean, it's, you know, when I began teaching at the university a decade ago, I would have, out of any 10 students, I'd have one or two who was really functionally illiterate and had managed. this is not a top flight university. It's a...
What university are you at?
It's called Brunel University. It's outside London. This now I would say half of my class is functionally illiterate. And I even have some colleagues who are functionally illiterate in the English department.
Meaning they read Knausgaard.
No, meaning they can't write properly. They cannot pass an English sentence.
How do you work with them? How do you manage that?
How do I manage it? I just don't have anything to do with them as much as I can. The dog is looking a bit worried. What's up, honey?
You're getting all riled up about my struggle. Don't disturb the animal.
Yeah, don't disturb the animal. So, yeah.
You know, Knausgaard had a dog, and he said he had to give it away because the barking reminded him of his father.
Okay. There's a trauma element. Although I think you just say that Knausgaard is not at all traumatized, that he's a high bottom? High bottom.
You've got a high trauma bottom.
High trauma bottom.
I don't know. I haven't read enough. I mean, I confess. Well, you know. I literally, I've read, you know, 30 or 40 pages of him.
I mean, that's why you're on the show.
Right.
If you were a scholar, you wouldn't be here. Although we actually have, ironically,
actually
oddly,
a
had
show,
a few scholars on.
Nice Danish man. Speaking of Danishes, but I was just thinking about, right, this first fifth of the novel, or whatever you want to call it, your memoir, about trying to, right, the device is you're trying to trade the Danishes for some heroin so you can go to work. And to me, that is, like, it's exploding a single small moment in time. Admittedly, this moment is more freighted than getting the beer to the New Year's Eve party. But there's something in both Knausgaard and in your book, I found that something so compelling and almost, like, addictive of wanting to get inside of this moment, which with all of its small details, it's just very compelling to me. And I think Knausgaard does that. Maybe not in as stylish of a way as you do, but I think that's where in his merit lies.
Well, yeah, but you know, you got to do the style as well. The style.
So it's okay. Okay. Yeah.
The style is the content. Style is, you know, it goes right back to the ancient Greeks' conception of poesis, the conception that the kind of expression, the verbal or written expression of being, literally conjures up a world. You know, so the mode in which you do it, the style in which you do it, is the only. You know, it seems to me the point is, this is like a kind of what my mother used to call a book of words. You know, you get a kind of electrical appliance. It comes with a book of words. You know, Knausgaard has written the kind of book of words for the life of somebody called Carl Olav Knausgaard. Okay. All right. The other thing is the kind of, you know, essentially, right, you know, talk about stay in your lane. Writers have become so timorous. You know, nobody's allowed to write about anything but their own fucking rear end. You know, it's like, you know, why
your
couldn't
own high bottom.
Right. Why couldn't they create some characters or some situations or some ideas of which he knew nothing? You know, that's what would be kind of interesting to
me. So you're making an argument for form in a sense, both on the sentence level of the sentence and on the level of the whole
and imagination. Imagination. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, what do you want to tell me? I've written 13 or 14 novels. I've written 4 or 5 collections of stories. I've written loads of stuff. I've written books about trying to imagine what it would be like if, you know, one of my earliest novellas was about, in the 90s, was about, you know, transitioning, people involuntarily transitioning sex, you know. You know, I've written
they
books.
They should bring that one back.
Well, I mean, it's never been out of print. You know.
Oh really?
So you know, I mean, imagination, the trilogy of novels I worked on through the 2010s was about the kind of dialectical relationship between warfare, technological advance, and mental illness. I mean, it was an attempt to use the novel form to say something interesting. Not just, you know, tell me that a fucking Norwegian man doesn't have a great life or does have a great life or pisses off his partners because he writes about them in exhaustive detail.
Okay, I'm going to push back against this one word. It's does achieve anti-narrativity in a way, right? You're railing against narrativity in this. And I think a lot of critics have noted this about his books, which is that as opposed to novels, which have the cheesy structure of the setup and the climax and the catharsis, right? Most importantly, the catharsis and narrative. There's no narrative in this. It actually does mimic how life is, which is people drift in and out. A character will appear, is named, is described, is never seen again, has no ulterior significance to
yeah,
this.
Well, I'm with that. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, but I mean, you know, I can draw your attention to my own work, which does not have a narrative in that sense at all either.
Yeah,
you know, there you can be a hell of a lot more inventive and actually create characters and, you know, write about. You know, doesn't he want to? You know, I've written three or four novels with female protagonists. Doesn't he want to experience the excitement of writing in a woman's mind?
Well, it's funny you bring
that
up.
I've written a novella written from the point of view of a British Asian character. Doesn't he want to experience what other people are like in other cultures? What's the point of being a fucking writer if all you're going to write about is your own miserable fucking Norwegian maleness?
Well, it's funny you say that, Will, because his new novel, The Morning Star, it's told from the perspective of like 12 different characters. And in an interview, in this interview that was caused proximately by our podcast, because the interviewer had been on our show and the New York Magazine asked her to interview Knausgård. She asks him, and she's a trans woman, and she asked him, well, how did you feel about writing a female character for the first time? And he responded, at first, I confined myself only to things I was sure women would do, such as she's drinking a cup of coffee, she's looking at a tree.
Okay.
So it's really
never how I've written female characters. I always start by thinking, what do women do that I don't do?
That's the difference.
And how would it be different to be a person who experienced those things?
Yeah. By the way,
I'm sorry. One of the things that strikes me most about writing women characters is women menstruate. Men don't. You know, it's a big fucking deal. You know, and the number of the amount of shit you read by men who are attempting and women who are attempting to inhabit women characters who seem to neglect this elementary fact of biology is beyond me. But there you go.
There's a lot of neglect of elementary biology in novels, though. Like, characters aren't actually. I guess we do get shitting in Knausgård, but
you get quite a lot of shitting.
We don't see the daily defecation, the daily urination. Why? Why is there a paucity of that kind of shit?
Well, I think it's part of the death of modernism. And it was always said that, you know, that Joyce had not just taken characters into the bedroom, but also into the bathroom. I think that readers have been struggling to get back out again ever since. You know, readers want to live in a world where everything wipes clean, where our endings are happy. You know, you guys must understand that. You know that. You know, people want their catharsis. They want, and they'll have it. And the other thing I think is that, you know, again, it's to do with your generation. When, you know, it's a bit like the point about demography and age. I think mm-hmm. the sheer volume of narrative available to people now, you know, I think everybody's become quite sophisticated in, you know, you can watch 5 minutes of a streamed Netflix or Amazon show and you can anticipate where that dramatic arc is going to land. You know, the old adage that there's only seven plots, you know, when you've been in lockdown and you've been, surfing this shit for a few weeks, you know how everything's going to fucking happen. How people manage to suspend disbelief is beyond me.
I know. I was really moved watching your interview with what was the one with the marketing guy, where you were talking about the role of narrative in marketing. And you said, I tried to write this down, we're probably the first culture that absolutely understands narrative takes away as much as it delivers, which struck me as very true. And also,
if only people did, they'd stop buying this shit, though, ultimately, wouldn't they? I mean, they would stop.
I think they know. I think they do understand that. And I think that's why we feel this kind of deadness when we watch a Netflix show, because we know we're being manipulated.
Mm. But it's that, and it's the tyranny of film, which I also write about in the trauma piece. God, okay. You know, it's the reduction in shot speed. It's the use of the only editing technique, the only montaging technique is cross cutting. Yeah, you know, there's this sort of fix. You watch that stuff. I mean, I don't watch it anymore. You watch it for like an hour and your eyes are like have been moved around so decisively on the screen that you get this kind of tense headache and you're kind of.
Yeah.
When you know how they're doing it, you just can't watch it anymore. You know, once you understand. Watch early cinema. You know, this year is the 100th anniversary of you know, the really great decade of silent cinema, the last 10 years of silent cinema. I mean, whether it's the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or Metropolis or Sunshine or any of these films, Sunrise, they did everything before 1929. They'd done everything. And it's great, and it's quiet, and it's slow, and it's so beautiful. Early cinema. And you know, Benjamin said, you know, the work of art loses its aura in the age of its technological reproducibility. But something strange has happened with early cinema. It's recovered its aura. Because you look at these early films, and they have an enormous potency to them, precisely because, well, Goethe said, you know, when a new medium arises, the first artist to work in it will usually do everything you can do. And if they're geniuses, they'll do everything. I mean, of course, he was thinking of himself. But the truth of the matter is, it's certainly true of film. If you watch the great movies of the 1920s with an unbiased eye, I think you'll come back to me and say, well, you were right. They've done it.
Maybe all. I will.
Yeah.
Maybe I will. I have Criterion Channel, so I think they have some of that stuff on there.
Yeah. Well, it's free on YouTube. You can just watch it.
Oh, it's all on YouTube?
Yeah. Nice. Or try the BFI site. I don't know if it functions in the US, the British Film Institute site. Has a lot of good stuff on it.
Nice. One should be watched.
Well, I would start with Dr. Mabuse, The Gambler. It's a huge film, two parts, 6 hours long, extraordinary film, extraordinary. Or Abel Gance's Napoleon, 8 hours long.
It sounds like good fodder for our métier.
I know,
Exhausted.
Well, what do you think about Bergman's Fanny and Alexander? We were talking about that in our last episode.
Beautiful film, lovely film. And you know, again,
but it's
like
a talkie.
It's a talkie, yeah, but but it the shots are relatively long. I mean, you know,
yes,
when
the shots are so long.
Yeah.
So long.
But I mean, that thing, there's a very good, if you're interested, I'll send you, there's a very good academic paper on the tyranny of film. It's a comparatively recent phenomenon. I mean, I was looking at Koslowski's Three Colors movies, There's a shot in Three Colors Blue of Juliette Binoche crying for 2.5 minutes with a locked off camera. I mean, you just couldn't conceive of such a thing in contemporary Hollywood. It's so moving. She just goes on crying and crying and crying.
I had that thought while I was watching.
Sounds like some girls I know. It lasts longer than 2.5 minutes. Try 12 minutes.
How about that?
That's its own kind of tyranny, the tyranny of tears.
Well, yeah, I guess. But, you know, what would it be like if you couldn't cry? What a disaster that would be, eh?
Yeah. But, yeah, I absolutely had that thought watching Fauna and Alexander last month. I think that's part of why it was so moving. There's a part at the very end where the Jewish uncle or friend of the family tells the story about his dream. And it's all it is just the camera on him, like, zooming in, like, a little bit at a time. Mm. And I was like, holy shit, man, like, you would never see this anymore. It's
no. Really, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, good writer as well, Bergman, like a lot of film directors, his memoir, The Magic Lantern, is very, very good. Indeed.
Yeah. Would you say there's an analogous process in like contemporary fiction too, kind of like tyranny of certain conventions that sort of stultifies and deadens us?
I honestly don't know. I tried reading a bit of this now, Scott, because I was talking to you guys, but on the whole, I just don't read contemporary fiction and haven't done for many, many years. I scarcely know what's happened in it. I always found it got in the way. I was writing a lot of fiction myself. My analogy would be, it's like, you know, watching somebody write, you know, if you're a professional writer, watching somebody reading fiction, it's like watching a seal balance a ball on its head. You know, you've been doing it yourself all day. You don't want to watch some other poor fucking seal doing the same thing, you know?
Yeah. So
and also, you know, most of it's shit. It really is. It's just shit. And you know, there's a thing psychologists call confirmation bias, mm-hmm. which is, you know,
I've heard of it. Yeah.
Right. So, you know what it is, when something has a strong attribute, like a guy or a woman's really good looking, you think she or he is smart and so on and so forth. You know, nothing succeeds like success, and most success is because of prior success, you know, or because it's needed. And you know, my experience as a working artist now for, you know, over 30 years is it's mostly bullshit. The stuff that gets picked up and gets fated, even, you know, 5-10 years down the line, nobody remembers it. Everybody's forgotten it. It wasn't that important. It was just, you know, it was like kind of cultural bubble wrap. People just sat there popping for a while going, oh, this is great, popping this bubble wrap. And, you know, again, if you've published quite a lot, if you've written as a critic quite a lot, if you've been in this culture quite a lot, and you can't see how ephemeral it is, or how much, you know, positive judgments, you know, people, you know, books or any other works of art tend to acquire likes, like, you know, Instagram influencers on the up, then you're a very, very limited person, you know, and no. No. I mean, we're seeing it particularly at the minute because there's a Gotta Dameron of literary reputation going on right now as we shift to this completely content-driven age when what matters is who writes the book, not right. You know, what the book, and what the book's about, the book not is how immature. They write the book. And, you know, what we're seeing is, you know, it's most notably in the States with Philip Roth's death recently or with... you know, somebody like Norman Mailer, who's just kind of, I mean, you may argue they were the most egregious, chauvinistic, sexist male writers imaginable. And maybe there are some nicer male writers from that generation that will be saved. But really? Are people really reading a lot of William Styron or Saul Bellow? Or, yeah, I don't know.
I'm reading my Bellow.
You are?
Drew is. Good. Drew's I'm the last guy. Yeah.
Daily regimen of Bellow.
Okay, well, you know, but you know, that's kind of what's going on at the moment, and it should give people cause for reflection. You know, the canon has been dismantled in that way, so there's no there are no building blocks in anybody's understanding of what taste or, you know, and that's liberalism too. Liberalism demands that culture be, you know, and when liberalism has given up trying to make the present brilliant, it colonizes the past, goes after the past and tells the past it was wrong too and judges the past in that way. And that's the stage our culture is at. I mean, don't get me wrong. I really take no side in any of this. It's not my fight. I'm fucking out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
No side on it. I mean, and in fact, I happen to think, you know, the whole conflict points up how complex our feelings are, you know, and we can never simplify that complexity.
Well, except we can, and that's what discourse is now, is it's just super flattened and simple, and for that reason, impossible to engage with or want to engage with. We're actually vehemently anti-discourse on this podcast.
Yeah, we're kind of like you. We're sort of hermit-like in our approach.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly think that, you know, as the climate emergency unfolds, and I think that the pandemic is just the outlier, there's going to be more zoonotic illnesses coming down the pipeline.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
And you know, I feel for you guys. I've brought up all my own children, bless you, to understand that there might well be short, you know, near-term social collapse as a result of the climate emergency within their lifetimes. I didn't think I'd see it in mine, but I think I will now, as long as my health hangs on. And I think that people, you know, you don't have to be a Marxist to understand that cultural forms relate to economic and social bases. And you know, a lot of the deformations we're experiencing in culture at the moment seem to me analogous to the kind of pressure ridges you get in an ice flow when it pushes up against a landmass. You know, that's the end there that's making everything seem so bumpy now. It's the end that lies in the near future. And, you know, my great mentor as a writer was J.G. Ballard, who's a friend and kind of you know, and if there's one thing Ballard was, it's prescient, and I think it's not without accident that most of his fiction is dystopic and apocalyptic as well, and I think we're living in very parlous times, and that's why I'm sorry, the kind of conflict, the culture wars, just, you know, that they're not something I can take a side in at all. I mean, well, partly because I agree with some of both sides and I disagree with some of both sides. So. But yeah, there it is.
I took a little bit of an issue with, I was trying to reconcile what I thought to be a little bit of a paradox when you were talking about, what's this guy's name, Strawson's Against Narrativity. And you were taking aim, or Strawson rather takes aim at Oliver Sacks, famously of The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, who is saying that the self is a perpetually rewritten story, which, as you say, is kind of a shibboleth of our time, is that we are our narrative, right? And you kind of dismiss this, but on the other hand, isn't this whole Against Trauma essay about how we are our narrative, and then when our narrative collapses, we have a little bit of psychosis? I don't understand how...
If it is a narrative, it's a narrative that we don't consciously enunciate. It's really when we're in flow states and they're interrupted that we're traumatized. You know, narrativizing implies a great deal of concentration. And it's really back to dear old Nausgaard, because as you rightly point out, he's a modernist in the sense that he resists the idea of a narrative arc in any given life. And I think what I wanted to object to, and I mean, not to name drop or anything, but I knew Sacks as well, and he was a big influence on me, most notably my novel Umbrella. But I think he's wrong on that. I think that idea, I mean, what Strawson draws a line between is what you might call narrativity and strong narrativity. So strong narrativity is the idea that you have a kind of moral duty to tell your story. And I think that kind of chimes in with a certain kind of view of trauma as being a kind of mental infarct that kind of destroys your ability to tell your story in that way. And I think that's why it becomes a synecdoche for all of modern ills, is because it kind of links in with that shibboleth of strong narrativity, that you have some kind of moral obligation to account for yourself in that way. again, you know, I think that that's one of the things that liberal humanism takes from religion without, and particularly from Judeo-Christian religion, without acknowledging it. I mean, who are you telling the story to? God. You know, I mean, there's nobody else to tell that story to, you know, and it doesn't matter how many readers Now Scarred gets. I would suggest that the person he's really trying to speak to is a God he doesn't really believe in.
I'm still trying to parse this difference between strong narrativity and narrativity.
Well, narrativity, strong narrativity is there's a kind of, not only is everybody's life really a story that they that can be told, but that they further have a moral obligation to tell it. It's not kind of, you know, in other words, you're not, and it kind of, it's certain kind of misinterpretations of Freudian theory kind of dovetail with that. You know, the idea you've got to be healthy, to effect catharsis properly, you have to tell the story in that way. And don't get me wrong, I think Strawson goes too far the other way. He goes the sort of Theseus's ship way. You know, he distinguishes between, as it were, synchronic and diachronic people. And he says he's completely synchronic. That he, you know, when he looks back at the little boy falling over in the playground age 7, he can see nothing of himself in that child. You know, there is a complete disjunction. I think that's an overstatement. I think the truth of the matter is we move between the two constantly. Half the time we're convinced we're the same person we were in the womb, and half the time we absolutely know it isn't the case. And in a way, sanity is being able to contain this plenitude of multiple rememberings, forgettings, narrativizings, failures to narrativize. You know, sometimes my personality is a limerick. You know, sometimes it's a silent movie. You know, it's like a... But it's not, you know, I think there's a sort of awful, you know, presumably what you most dislike is a kind of intersection between a certain view of the people have of themselves as narrativized and stories that need to be told, and a certain kind of really shit novel, you know, that is just so obviously, you know, I mean, it's what I always say to Tyro writers. If you sit down writing for catharsis, you're going to produce shit art. It's only ever a byproduct, if that, of trying to make books properly.
I was trying to find the quote from Sontag from On Photography, but it was some line that's like haunted me for like a decade or something. And she says something like, the existence of cameras convinces us that we are worthy of being seen. Mm. And I think that's what you're saying here. What is it? The popularity of Knausgaard's exhaustively quotidian struggle doesn't I wonder if the popularity of Knausgaard's excessively quotidian struggle doesn't reflect the inception of social media during the same period. All those selfies posted on Instagram, all those tweets proclaiming ephemeral yet passionate likes and dislikes, all those meals that live forever on Facebook despite long since having been evacuated. What are all these if not the multitude conforming resolutely to the dictum that they all have a novel in them? To be specific, an autobiographical novel prolapsing, nice use of prolapsing, with the Hitlerian bombast of its own trivia. It's just the existence of these platforms, right? I don't know if it's the cart leading the horse, but I think it's compelling us to be producing these narratives, which is why I was resisting the idea that we're not, in fact, a narrative of our own life. We're all telling, we're, you know, incontinent with narrative, I think.
Yeah, that's right. But it's being provoked. I mean, we kind of come full circle because in a way, you know, you wouldn't be putting it up there if you didn't want it to be seen. So the key thing here is being looked at. You know, that's why the Sontag quote haunts you. It is, again, it's not the medium is the message as ever. And the message is, look at me, please look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me. So the message is just primary egoism and narcissism. And the media kind of weaponizes it in that way and massively enhances it. And yeah, I think there is some sort of synergy there between the success of Now Scarred and the rise of social media. I mean, because again, it's back to what I was saying. Social media gives you all of the appurtenances of fame, psychological appurtenances,
right? Yeah,
but none of the actual real world benefits because it's decoupled from hierarchy. you no longer, you know, it's what Guy Debord, the French situationist, called spectacular celebrity. You know, he said in the Society of the Spectacle, in the future, a chef will be known for his political opinions and a politician for his cookery tips.
Oh, Jesus Christ, he's so right. Oh, my God.
Yeah, right, but he was writing in 1967.
No, but that literally has come to pass.
Yeah, and it's literally come to pass.
But, AOC posting her recipes on Twitter,
Right, but this is a world that is planar. It's flat in that way. Nothing kind of rises above it. So along comes this kind of not very good Norwegian writer whose one fucking strength is his doggedness, his dogged egoism, and let's face it, extraordinary narcissism. Because you know, Joyce was not as narcissistic as Nausgaard, because Joyce didn't believe he wrote one autobiographical novel, and it's only Jaebik.
Yeah, but the achievement of Knausgård is its extensiveness, right? That's the provocation.
Right, but it's so extensive because it's many, many social media posts.
Okay. Then, so is that what you get without a god? You know, he's merely writing for this kind of nebulous audience that, and we're all narrativizing ourselves. Like, who? It's a strange way, in the same way that we're all famous without any benefits of the fame. Knausgård seems to have some, relationship with God then in this failed dialogue, but none of the actual consolation of belief. I'm not sure. Maybe it's a forced connection, but like, who's watching us if there is no God? We're just surveilling each other, I suppose.
Our Instagram followers,
Yeah.
I think it is an attempt, you know, it's a map the same size as the territory, the web. And it is an attempt to create a kind of, you know, it's omniscient. We figure it as omnipotent. It's always, you know, it knows the future. It knows the past. Yeah, it's a kind of God. It's a kind of God. And it's a God that is composed. It's a profoundly humanistic God because it's composed of all of the kind of little people who are involved in it. And, you know, if you ever when people start to defend social media, you know, hard cases make bad law. They're always defending it on that basis. It's always, you know, and you know, my youngest son is autistic spectrum, and he wouldn't have a social existence without the web. Or would he?
I don't know. Yeah, I remember I lived in China for 5 years, and I remember we were doing field work in some village in Anhui province in the mountains, like pretty remote village. And there was a village idiot. Like, there was, like, back in the old days, there was a guy who had some kind of disability who just followed everyone around. But it struck me that this guy was part of the community, right? He wasn't shunted aside or put into like a segregated category. Everyone, they just like, they weren't exactly crazy about him, but they were like, yeah, that's the guy and we accept him because we have to, essentially.
Well, I mean, don't you have village idiots where you are?
No more village idiots. Are you kidding? They're all in like special schools and stuff like that. They're not.
Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean by an idiot. I mean, so for example, like 300 meters down the road from me, there's a middle-aged, well, actually she's 10 years older than me. She's an old African Caribbean woman, Lilith. And she's very eccentric, shouts all the time, talks to people in the street. She lives out on the street all the day. She's not mad though. I wouldn't even say she was necessarily a village idiot in any sense, but she's a totally non-standard person who cannot fit into. Yeah, no, they're fascinating, aren't they? And I remember two or three years ago, I went back to a district of London I'd worked in years ago. I'd run a kids' playground, adventure playground, in this place called Richmond. And there was a village idiot who hung around the kids' playground. And this is like around my memoirs set in the 1980s. I went back there about 3 or 4 years ago, and the minute I came out of the subway, there was the same guy.
He was still there?
Yeah, and he was exactly the same. I thought, you know, it's sort of idiot power. I thought
that's
just
beautiful. I love that.
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah.
I love the way he'd endured.
Yeah. I'm surprised he didn't get like taken in for like pedophilia or something like that. Like,
well, that's right. It was an innocent era, the past, in respect of that. Innocent in this sense, people didn't know about things like that, so they didn't look out for them. And the 70s were extraordinary in terms of, you know, I mean, it was decades of dyadic. The 60s weren't really the 60s. The 70s were the 60s. Mm. That's when the real shit went down. Listen, guys, I'm loving talking to you, but time is getting on and I'm going to have to take the dog out.
Okay. Go see the Village Idiots.
I mean, what do you do with this?
Can I ask you about Morrissey before we leave?
Yeah, you can ask me about Morrissey.
So you met him, right? You've interviewed him?
Right, but like 25 years ago.
Can you tell us what kind of experience that was? We're just obsessed with him, so anything you have.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm reasonably... ambi sexual person. He was one of the sexiest guys I've ever met. Yeah, he was awesome. Really, really attractive man. Very, I mean, just it's that black hair and blue eyes combination we all love. And he was when he was particularly. I mean, he's always been into rough trade. I mean, I had a number of insights into Morrissey that probably aren't for general publication, because I knew quite a good friend of mine led his band on the first two studio albums, so I heard quite a lot about what Stephen was up to then. But you know, he was particularly into kind of rough trade, Vauxhall and I, Southpaw Grammar. And he was very fit himself. He was boxing, I think, at the time, so he was hench. And I think initially there might have been a little spark. But I went along to the gig and I took my then girlfriend, and one of his gophers came out to you know what it's like. The after show party isn't the real party that's going on, but came out to the after show party to take the people who were going to be taken into, you know, the Lord God's presence. And I was not among them. And I think it was because the girlfriend was there, but I could be wrong about that.
Oh, you blew your chance with Morrissey.
You miffed it with Morrissey.
I didn't really actually want to kind of be bummed by him, you know.
Well, you could have bummed him.
I suspect he's a pitcher, not a catcher.
That's interesting. I would not have guessed that. I would have thought the opposite. But
90% of gay men are pitchers, not catchers.
Wait, then how does it all work?
Other way around. There's a critical top shortage in New York.
How do you know?
Sources.
Sources close to the podcast have told us.
The Village Idiot told us.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
three corner.
You know, in Italy, it's not even considered gay to sodomize another man. I mean, that's not gay. That's just.
No, it's not considered gay on this podcast either.
That's lunch. You know. It's
Oh man. Well, that's great to know. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you for reaching out, as we say.
No, it was really wonderful to talk to you, Will.
This is great.
This is our season premiere. This is so you're like our splashy season premiere guest.
Well, as I said, the last thing I'd want to say is, you know, I said some snarky things about poor old Knausgård, or however you pronounce it. Maybe he's better, you know. I don't know. I mean, I don't fucking know. I've only read about 40 or 50 pages of the guy. I don't know. Maybe it's better, but this problem of a lack of style really eats away at me. Why are you writing it? Why, you know? And again, I do relate that to specular technology, because it seems to me that when writers, you know, in the old days, you'd be writing, right? You'd be writing on your typewriter, right? Even if you were on a computer, there was no web, and you'd think. Oh, she was wearing a leopard skin pillbox hat and driving a red Corvette, a red 1965 Corvette. And you'd think, did that have really big fins or not? I want to describe the fins. And nowadays, you're still thinking in words, though. You're thinking in words. Nowadays, you just call it up on the computer screen and you describe the image. And that is not writing. Describing an image is not writing. Writing is when you inhabit words and you write from the position that words are thought. And it's that that this kind of content-driven writing resiles from. It treats words as descriptors. So in a way, it's as if Saussure never happened. The signifier was never arbitrary at all. And indeed, you know, one of the paradoxes is, on the one hand, postmodernism is characterized by a deep suspicion of words, the incommensurability of words and actuality. And on the other hand, its styleless prose points to the fact that that's all we desire, is that we can somehow, you know, be sure that when he's called it a spade, it is indeed a spade, you know, that's because he saw a picture of one on fucking Google. You know?
Have you ever been in the same room as Knausgård?
I don't think so. Why would I?
I just wanted to know if you were taller than him or not, because we're still trying to figure out his exact height, and that would be a helpful, you know,
all right.
For us. Yeah.
Well, you know, if I ever see the guy, I think it's exceedingly unlikely now, but I'll make sure to shimmy up right next to him.
Don't worry, he does not listen to this show, nor does he have any awareness of it. And I don't think
he does. No, people have told him about it, but he keeps pretending that he's never heard about it before.
Well,
but anyway, we're never going to have him on the show.
I haven't read enough Knausgård to talk to him.
Will, I wanted to address you as the lanky cunt when you appeared on the screen, but I didn't have the nerve, so I'm calling you right now. This was in his book. I'm taking this from your book.
Oh, yeah.
A friend of yours called you the lanky cunt, which I think is a great expression.
Right.
You were going to appear on the screen, and I was going to be like, well, if it isn't the lanky cunt, but I didn't.
Yeah, I don't think that would have gone that well.
I don't think it would have gone over that well.
Yeah, I don't know. I have a certain degree of amour propre, right? I hope not too great, but some, you know.
A bond of trust has been abused, something of value may be lost. Give up your job, squander your cash, be rash, just hold onto your